What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back, or welcome to the High Flyers podcast. For the curious ones, where we share diverse experiences in life, not just work, tune in and learn to fly high in your own way, from value creators and problem solvers at all aspects of society. Learn about their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and so much more to help us all be 1% better every day together. And I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal.
It really was a huge turning point. I think just that experience of walking down the street and having people look at you and half of the people going, oh, that's awesome, I get it, you know, that's funny, or you know, having a positive reaction to it. And then the other 50% of people genuinely thinking you are a full-on weirdo and they don't want a bar of you and they don't get it. To me, sort of at the time, reflecting on that, it was really difficult and I almost threw in the towel and thought, you know, look, I don't need to do this. I can just go and have a fun holiday. But I persevered, and it really, for me, at the completion of the trip, you know, having that realization that there's 50% of the people, there will always be, you know, 50% of people who don't get you, don't understand you, don't really sort of, maybe don't like you.
That's Andy Miller, and this is episode 51. Here Andy's journey that started in Queensland, Australia, being a free-range kid, as he calls it, to now being co-founder and CEO of Heaps Normal, the non-alcoholic beer brand, building a movement and putting a new spin on consuming a beverage. We cover Andy's time playing water polo in his later high school years and traveling the world playing in competitions, the desire to be a doctor growing up but realizing through a mentor that a creative path would be more suitable, traveling the world in pajamas, 10 countries in 10 weeks, which is a winning entry in the Triple J competition called Claim to Funny Shit, and gave Andy his first break into branding and marketing. We cover Andy's time living and working in China for 3 years, how to brand Storytel, and we go into the Heaps Normal story, the period that led to going all in, launching during a pandemic, name options, and whether the journey so far has met or exceeded Andy's expectations. And due to some sound difficulties, my sound on my end isn't quite as smooth as it usually is, but Andy sounds great, and that's all that matters. Enjoy.
Andy, welcome to the show. You've come highly recommended, so I'm excited to share your journey.
Thanks, mate. It's really it's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start off with some quick facts just to give the listener a bit of perspective about Andy as a person. So where were you born?
I was born in Brisbane and grew up there for most of my life. So, yeah, proud Queenslander.
First job?
First job. If we go right back, I was just barely legal, working as a newspaper wrapper at 3 o'clock in the morning at the back of a news agency with a very loud, very manual machine that broke down a lot.
I'm sure that gives you the scrappiness to run a business now.
Yeah, it was terrifying as a kind of 16-year-old.
And what would you say you do now? Like, how would you describe your work now?
Well, I'm the CEO and co-founder of Heaps Normal. That may kind of be a little bit different. My day-to-day is probably a little bit different to what some people might imagine. It's definitely a lot of getting my hands dirty. I really still enjoy the process of coming up with ideas, but more and more it's about, I think, giving people the space to come up with great ideas for themselves in our team and sort of amongst our partners, and looking to play more of a coaching role and set the direction for where we want to go so that we can make the most of the talented people that we have in our team.
I'm excited to talk a lot about Heaps Normal, but let's talk about Andy Andy the individual first. Now, given the name of the show, Andy, and the ethos about reimagining a high flyer, is there a high flyer in your life that you feel perhaps hasn't got the recognition today?
Sounds like a bit of a cliche, but my wife is genuinely a high flyer. She flies under the radar a lot as well because of her role, her professional role. But yeah, I think she's such an amazing support to me, and we have a really really kind of great relationship where we kind of carve out moments at different points in our lives for each other to kind of take the lead. And she's just relocated to Bangkok for her work, so we're navigating this next phase where I think she's going to need to step up and take the lead again.
No, exciting, and that's probably another one we'll talk about as you move coming up and what that means for Heaps Normal in terms of perhaps an expansion into Asia that listeners might have heard first here on the show. So now, if you talk about your sunrise, Andy, and your upbringing in your early years, you talked about Queensland. Tell me about that. Tell me about the influence of your environment and family growing up.
Yeah, I feel like growing up in Brisbane in the 80s, showing my age a little bit, but growing up in Brisbane in the 80s was such an amazing place to be, an incredible climate. Everyone was outside. It's kind of that quintessential Australian story of free range kids growing up, playing out on the streets together, going sort of on adventures through the bush blocks and that sort of stuff, and spending a lot of time on weekends and in holiday periods at the beach on the Sunshine Coast with grandparents. And it was just really grateful for the opportunity to have that kind of childhood where, you got plenty of time to play and encouraged a lot to play a lot of sport, a lot of different sports, but also have that balance with, music, learning music for my whole life and having a really supportive home and family kind of environment to grow, I guess.
And tell us about your parents, what did they do and what was their role in your upbringing?
My parents I'm back living at home now, so it's for a couple of months. So it's an interesting time to be reflecting on my parents, but they were always really super supportive and caring. I think I think some people in my friendship circle, refer to their parents as mates. And I don't think I ever had those kind of parents. They were real kind of traditional parents, but parents who kind of invested a lot of their own time and energy in making sure that, their privilege or their, the results of their hard work were passed on, and that we had the best opportunities all the way through our childhood. And that meant, everything from stretching themselves to be up at 5 a.m. to take us to swimming training every morning, all the way through to, making sure that, we could attend a private school. And I feel a little bit guilty about not making the most of that opportunity either. they were kind of my dad's an engineer by trade and has worked in the government for most of his life. My mum is a real creative soul, does a lot of patchwork, and has done that for her whole life, and spent a lot of her time managing the house and kind of making sure that we always had somebody at home with us to help us with homework and be kids.
I'm glad you mentioned the school part, because I was very similar. I didn't make the best use of it coming back, and I think that's something my parents always will never make me forget. So
yeah, I've been very kind to my parents about not reminding me too much about that.
But I think we both turned out okay. So hopefully our parents are appreciative of where we're at in our lives. So, and tell me, I'm always fascinated. Did you have any heroes outside of your direct family unit? Did you have any posters on the wall growing up that were you, kind of people you looked up to?
I definitely did. And I'm sure that there are better examples than this one, but there is just this image burned into my mind of my childhood hero. I was asked the same question by like a child psychologist early on. I think my temper tantrums were kind of getting out of hand at one point for my mum when I was a real kind of youngster, and she took me along to speak to a child psychologist, and they asked me the same question. I said Inspector Gadget, and so that was my favorite series at the time, and I think maybe just the versatility of this guy, but actually if anyone knows Inspector Gadget, he's actually a bit of a fool, and it's Penny, his daughter, who always ends up saving the day. So I don't know if there's something subliminal to read into that, but that was the kind of fun, kind of adventurous character that I really enjoyed.
I like it. It's different from the usual sports or music or movie star that people tend to say, so it's specific, which is nice. And then tell me about high school, Andy. Like, how would your teachers describe you? How would your classmates describe you? What were your passions in high school?
I played a lot of sport all the way through my childhood. I swam almost every day from about the age of, I think, seven or eight. Played a lot of soccer and tennis. I was very bad at cricket. And in my kind of high school years, being a fairly average swimmer when it came to my speed, I didn't make the swim team, and so rather than sort of continue down that path, by the age of about 16, I thought, oh, there's got to be a better way for me to apply my swimming ability, and so that turned into being one of the founding members of our school water polo team. And that became a sport that I just fell in love with, and ended up training twice a day every day for the remaining 2 years of my high school life, and then had the opportunity to that sport actually ended up taking me around the world, and gave me a lot of different opportunities and a really kind of amazing set of friends, and just became a really exciting part of my life for quite a few years.
Oh, incredible. I mean, I've got a huge appreciation for water polo players just trying to stay afloat underwater and then play with a ball and almost do soccer in water is fascinating. Are you still involved? Do you still play in any aspect?
I'm not at the moment. Okay. last year I did finally take the plunge, no pun intended, genuinely no pun intended, back into a local club here in Canberra. COVID got in the way, and I kind of got back out of the rhythm, but it certainly reminded me of how fit I used to be.
And then that was probably going to be my next question around, you mentioned you're playing that through your sort of later teenage years, traveling the world. Was that your ambition in life, to become a professional water polo player? Like, what was success to you at the age of 16, 17?
I think there was just a lot of pressure to follow a certain path coming out of a private school environment. Most of my mates were, their version of success was becoming a lawyer, or going and studying commerce, law, or science, becoming a lawyer, becoming a doctor. And my childhood dream was actually to be a doctor. I wanted to be a doctor my entire life, but like I touched on earlier, I didn't make the most of the opportunity that was presented to me at school. Instead of studying for 4 hours a day. I was in the pool for 4 hours a day. And I don't think I ever necessarily thought about water polo as a professional career, but it was something that I discovered that I was good at. And so that was, yeah, that was kind of just really fulfilling at the time. And obviously, you know, all of the fringe benefits of exercising all the time, you know, feeling really healthy, having lots of energy. It was a real, really great outlet for me. I really didn't, I was in the back of my mind somehow thinking that I'd just miraculously pull off becoming a doctor without getting the grades or doing the study time, which was a bit of a delusion, I think, in hindsight, obviously. But it wasn't until my third year of university when I did an internship, and one of my mentors at that time called out that, you know, they could see you know, a creative side of me, and suggested a pathway through advertising could be something that they thought I would be good at. And at the time I was studying health science, you know, still kind of perpetuating this delusion that, you know, I might use that as a kind of pathway back on track towards studying medicine. And I just had this realization at that moment in my life. It was a really big turning point for me that, you know, one, there was no reason why, even though these kind of quote unquote fun careers or fun jobs were highly competitive, which is sort of what I'd been taught, there was no reason that I couldn't succeed in that pathway. And that this mentor, Alana, was her name, who I worked with at Southbank Corporation in Brisbane. She sort of helped me realize that there was no reason why I couldn't succeed in that sort of highly competitive, you know, that highly competitive environment for quote unquote fun jobs. So that's sort of, that was the beginning of a kind of short career in advertising.
Yeah, and I know you went off on a bit of a trip in your 20s. So was that after university or was that prior to university?
That was sort of around that time. That was second year university. I'd got a bit of a bug for traveling by going on a couple of water polo tours, and came back and thought, yeah, I need to do something. I need to come up with something that's worth writing about. And this was sort of another person I think in my professional circles who had sort of suggested that I was wasting my time sitting in a government job in a cubicle. And needed to do something a little bit more creative. So I took that advice and came up with this idea of traveling around the world in my pajamas as a bit of a social experiment. That was the idea that I came up with in order to kind of have a reason for something to write about. So I set off for 10 weeks, 10 countries, traveling the entire time in my pajamas and, just sort of taking note of the way people responded to me.
How good is that, right? You didn't just travel, you traveled in your pajamas. And I need to ask you this. Did you not change out of your pajamas at all? So were you in pajamas the whole trip, or did you have periods where you'd go to a bar and they'd say, sorry, you can't come in, you need to get changed and come back? Like, how did it work?
This is going to sound even more ridiculous, but the moments that I changed out of my pajamas were actually to go to bed, to sleep. Because obviously when you're wearing pajamas for the entire day, you know, usually they're the sort of nice, clean, you know, bed clothes that you put on to go to sleep. And in my case, the t-shirt and jeans or shorts that were in my suitcase were, you know, the clean set of clothes that I put on to go to bed.
And what do you think in reflection now, and obviously been a fair bit of time has passed since then, that that's played a role in your life? Do you think that's made you more aware of the world and kind of took you on the path that you went on post that trip? Like, what would life have been now if you didn't go on that trip?
I don't even know, actually. It sounds like a really trivial kind of moment in my life, I guess, from the outside maybe. But for me, it really was a huge turning point. I think just that experience of walking down the street and having people look at you and half of the people going, "Oh, that's awesome, I get it, you know, that's funny," or you know, having a positive reaction to it. And then the other 50% of people genuinely thinking you are a full-on weirdo and they don't want a bar of you and they don't get it. To me, sort of at the time, reflecting on that, it was really difficult and I almost threw in the towel and thought, you know, oh, look, I don't need to do this. I can just go and have a fun holiday. But I persevered, and it really, for me, at the completion of the trip, you know, having that realization that there's 50% of the people, there will always be, you know, 50% of people who don't get you, don't understand you, don't really sort of maybe don't like you, but 50% of people who are your supporters and cheerleaders and you know, want you to succeed. And for me, that was a really important turning point in my own personal resilience and, you know, belief that, you know, the 50% who don't get it, they don't really matter. You don't need to give energy to that 50%. You give the energy to the 50% who are kind of supporting, you know, who you are and, you know, what you want to be doing.
It reminds me of something a lot of guests have talked about, is owning your identity. And then to that point around, if you're yourself, you attract people who actually like who you are for you, not for putting on a face. And you mentioned about writing that experience. So how did that eventuate? Did you end up writing it into a blog, or did you talk about it on YouTube? I can't remember if you'd mentioned, I think in the lead up to this conversation, you're saying you might have recorded some of them on YouTube. Is that right?
No, not on YouTube. But at the time, it was quite, I mean, maybe I was just not as tech.
Was it pre-YouTube? Because it was early 2000s, right? So it probably was pre-YouTube.
It was, I think it was pre-YouTube. It was definitely pre the popularity, widespread popularity of YouTube. I managed to convince a kind of small creative agency at the time to code a website for me. So that was sort of where we're at. It wasn't really, blogs weren't really mainstream at that point. I did tell the story, which ended up becoming another turning point in my life. I told the story for a Triple J competition on air with Jay and the Doctor, which was, I think, claim to funny shit was the name of the competition. So I told them about my claim to funny shit and ended up winning and getting a return trip to Cardiff to meet the Foo Fighters backstage. And so that prize was that was really fun. But then that sort of facilitated me getting to know the team at Triple J, and I started photographing live music for them on a regular basis up in Brisbane. And then a job came up in marketing, and that was my first kind of proper marketing job, dream job for like early 20s. I moved to Sydney and became the sort of national marketing coordinator for Triple J, which was just mind-blowing kind of fun role for me at that point.
It definitely sounds like one of those magic moments that we talk about in the show, that is kind of an asterisk in your journey, right? And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think it encompasses something you mentioned earlier around putting yourself out there. And I think in today's society, we see it a lot more with social media and people kind of having a go. I mean, building podcasts or starting sort of creative work. But in the early 2000s, that wasn't prevalent. So it's really nice to hear that you took that leap of faith and belief, even when the schooling system and maybe your parents told you that you weren't good enough, and then you said, you know what, I don't care, I'm going to not be a doctor, but I'll go off and be a creative. So, and I'm sure that's paying off even now, that kind of entrepreneurial spirit and that willingness to question the norm.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely it's given me the confidence to believe that I am creative. And I think that's a weird thing, right? Because I think there's my sister's one, and there's a lot of people in my circles who don't think that they're creative. But I strongly believe, I never have seen myself as a creative. Like, I don't really think it's something that you're born with. I think I cultivated a creative side of me, and kind of learned how to be creative by surrounding myself with other creative people and you know, practicing at that. And I think I think it's just like any other skill. You learn how to be creative, how to have creative ideas, and you learn what kind of creative ideas work and which ones you know generally don't.
Now let's go deeper, Andy, into your magic moments, and this is probably a segment that listeners probably love the most, because it kind of goes beneath the surface a bit and hear some of those moments, like you mentioned, that are good, but also some of the painful learnings and perhaps the people you've met and experiences you've had. Is there a painful learning that stands out for you in life or work that played a big role in your life?
There were several, I think. Like the time in my life around high school, sort of definitely, having that sort of realization, not getting the grades, feeling like I'd let a lot of people down, including myself, by not kind of getting the academic results at that point in my life, which is obviously, it's a huge focus for a lot of 17-year-olds finishing high school. And so, yeah, that was a really painful learning to have to reassess, the path that I thought was, the success path, the path to success, reimagine what that looked like for me. But in hindsight, it was the best possible thing, or maybe it wasn't the best possible thing that could have happened, but it was, I think. It's sort of on reflection, I think what I've learned from that is that there's no dead ends. And even though something might feel like if you've got certain expectations and they don't come to light, then it might feel like a dead end, but there's always that, I guess, the idea of resilience. And I think stoicism, that philosophy is stoicism is that there's always, obstacles are just kind of put there to kind of challenge you on that path. And I think it's about how you navigate around that, how you see the opportunity from that situation rather than, the things that it's preventing you from doing.
And I noticed doing some research leading up to this, you spent a number of years in China, working in China and I think different roles. I'm not sure if you were actually based in China or if you were traveling between Australia and China. Talk to that, like what was sort of the magic moment there that led you to first make the move to China, and secondly, what kind of experiences did China teach you that you've sort of applied to your life since then?
I met my now wife a few months before she was due to move to China, and made the call, I think, before she knew that I'd made the call to move to China and give that a crack. And so that was a really unexpected opportunity and unexpected part of my journey. I never expected to live in China. It had never been on my radar, but it was one of the most exciting 3 years I think that I've had. And the opportunity to learn the language and learn a very different culture was, yeah, it was a really kind of exciting time. I spent 3 years there. I worked in advertising for some of the international advertising companies, agencies over there. And, but also, used that as an opportunity. I noticed an opportunity there to create a documentary music video project that documented some of the exciting things I noticed about the independent Chinese music scene over there.
Because I've actually had a few guests on the show that have lived or worked in China, and they've transitioned from a Western society into China. And one thing that's been prevalent that they've talked about is China, the narrative that we hear in the media is very different to China living there. And they'd moved at a similar time to you. I think they'd moved just before the Beijing Olympics in 2008. Did you find that similar to yourself, or did you find China was very welcoming and very kind of multicultural and a bit more diverse than what you hear in the media today about the China that we're sort of told?
Yeah, the narrative on China from afar is so different to what it is there. And I think maybe, you know, people who haven't experienced that might think of that as, well, that's the sort of the propaganda, machine at play. But it's, I think China gets a pretty raw assessment, gets from a lot of the international community. I think there's a lot of challenges, I think, that China has, but there's also there's a lot of amazing work that's being done. Even, you know, for example, I think a lot of negativity around China is centered on, you know, their environmental impact as a nation. But there's so many amazing. The size of the problem is a lot bigger, but there's a lot of really incredible. Both private and government-backed initiatives that would put a lot of other developed countries to shame, you know, including Australia.
Mm. And I think the one I wanted to ask you about is creative. I mean, you obviously mentioned creative early on with the pajama traveling story, but then since then you've worked in a whole raft of creative roles, right? You worked at brands kind of across so many different industries, and I've been fortunate to work in FMCG for a number of years and seen the kind of power of brands. What have been some of your learnings? I think there might be listeners who, back to what you said earlier, where they don't think they're creative, but they have that creative desire in them. What have you learned about brands and connecting stories to people that kind of helping you in your work today? Has there been one or two strands that you've learned that you kind of apply when you think of brand building or attracting a new brand or creating a new brand in the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think creativity, if I think about it now, is about kind of being able to empathize with people and combine new ideas. I think they're the sort of two things I think that I think I'm doing when I'm at my most creative. Being able to understand, when I say empathy, it's about being able to understand what really motivates people and what drives them. And then sort of on the other hand, be a researcher and uncover, you know, interesting elements that you can break apart and recombine in a new way. So in that sense, you know, I don't see creativity as, you know, synonymous with originality. I think people see it. Sorry, there's probably a lot to unpack there, but I think,
Whatever a tagline is that.
I think some people think, you know, creativity is about coming up with a brand new idea that no one's ever had before. And I don't see it that way. I see it generally speaking as the great ideas are already out there most of the time, and ideas are cheap for that reason. Ideas are everywhere. I think it's about picking the right ideas in the right time and in the right combination and then executing on those. And how you execute is the most creative part in my mind. How you combine different ideas, pick the right time, pick the right audience, and execute it in a way that is compelling and that really kind of gets across the sort of essence of, you know, what's in your head. That's the sort of most important part of the creative process, I think.
And I know you worked in, you mentioned before, you worked in sort of corporate industry like FMCG and retail and alcohol, but also arts and music and culture, right? Where would you say you found it the hardest? Or where was the steepest learning curve in your journey from a marketing, brand, creative aspect? Because I, from a third person point of view, I look at arts and culture, that kind of is all about that experience and atmosphere and art, whereas FMCG retail consumer is sort of often about the product and how you package that creative into a product like you are at Heaps Normal. Is there a period or a industry that you worked in that you found the most challenging and it was a new experience?
I found agency life really challenging because I, you know, like I said, I didn't really see myself as a creative. A lot of people sort of pushed me in that direction or guided me in that direction. And I started out agency life on the account side as an account executive. And then they too sort of said, oh, look, we think you're probably more suited to creative. So they made me a copywriter. And, you know, my writing was always an area of interest and something that I felt like I was reasonably good at. But then I was also interested on the visual side of things. And in my spare time, I was editing and art directing a magazine with a couple of friends of mine. And so I really saw myself as this generalist and wanted to cultivate those skills of being a generalist and understanding and being able to do like a range of different things to a certain, you know, to a certain, I guess, average or above average standard. But that didn't really fit with the way that employers employed people, including the agency that I worked at. And so, you know, I remember my creative director at the time saying, you know, you need to spend your time crafting your skill of copywriting and going deep on that and becoming the best writer that you can be. And I couldn't think of anything worse than just focusing on one thing and not sort of being interested in other stuff. And so I really pushed back on that and thought that, you know, I had all the answers. I wanted to be a generalist and I thought that would bring a lot of opportunities, but it brought a lot of challenges in the years that followed that. And I think even in China, especially in China, where, you know, being able to write in English was not necessarily a skill that was that useful for agencies over there at the time. You know, thinking of creative ideas in English in a different culture didn't translate necessarily either. And quite a few times in that period and in the period when I got back to Australia, you know, I had the response from people was, oh, we'd love to employ you. We're just not sure where we'd put you, like what role you would fulfill. Yeah. We don't have a role for you. So I reassessed at that point and thought, okay, you know, I've gone wide. I've been a generalist, you know, I've cultivated a lot of different skills. I've shot video and edited video and done, you know, art direction and copywriting and started, you know, businesses and events and that sort of thing. So what am I going to do? Like, what's the focus point of all of that experience? And that's when I landed on strategy and started when I got back, shortly after I got back from China, started at Pollen, which is a creative agency, as their strategy lead. And that was just an amazing opportunity of, you know, a 3-year period basically to learn and craft and practice writing strategy without, you know, any people management requirements or anything like that. It was a a small agency, a really creative team. And so it was the perfect environment, I think, in hindsight for me to get to learn strategy, get better at it, but also do it in a way that is creative, which is, again, I think, you know, people don't always relate strategy to creative, but I think strategy is an inherently creative practice.
Strategy is a good touch point to my next question that I thought of while you were saying that is the craft, and you see it with startups now often, is that craft of, particularly with tech companies, is the craft of marketing sort of evolving, where it's now more become about the distribution and reach and can you get a viral video straight away, and less so the actual art of it is putting in the creative and getting the right visual or the right color scheme or the right product itself. What are your thoughts on that as a business owner and kind of leader now? And we'll touch on Heaps Normal shortly, but do you see that evolving where that craft and focus is sort of getting lost and it's more about quick, how can we get reach very quickly and then find attraction?
Yeah, I think you see that. I don't know if it's a new thing, but I feel like there's always people with different motivations in every industry. And a lot of the time, I think people are motivated by seeing a trend and wanting to capitalize on it. I think the most successful examples in any industry, though, are those that have a real personal connection to the problem, and you know they're playing in a space where there's a lot of opportunity for growth, and but it's not the only thing that's driving them. There's an underlying purpose that gets them through the really tough, shitty times that you're going to have as a founder or as a startup business or even any small business. And I think if you don't have that underlying reason to get out of bed in the morning and do what you're doing, then as soon as the going gets tough, you're not really going to be in it. You know, you're going to want to pull the pin.
Absolutely. Now let's go into Heaps Normal. And then for any listeners wondering or haven't tried the brand, get out there and then buy the product. I had some the other day and it's delicious. I want to talk about the pre-Heaps Normal, because if someone looks at your LinkedIn, I think for a couple of years you worked at Young Henry's and you worked with a few brewing companies and startups in that sort of beverage alcohol space. Tell me about the moment that sort of gave you the inspiration to maybe not found, but maybe think about this idea called Heaps Normal, or even an idea that you want to kind of go into and leave a job and start. Like, was there a magic moment there over a period pre-2020 that led you to have that belief that you can do something?
Yeah, I should say I wanted to do something for a really long time. Wanted to do something for myself for a really long time. And I created a lot of projects, but never a business. I killed a lot of ideas before they, you know, really got a chance to be tested and whether they could be a business or not. And so definitely my time at Young Henry's gave me the confidence that I could do it. And that I just needed to, that's probably what was the missing ingredient, was confidence to just persevere beyond that initial excitement around having a great idea. In terms of Heaps Normal and, you know, I guess starting that, the things that really inspired me and I guess came together to make it happen were my experience in the category with Young Henry's. I learned a lot about what it means to be a beer company there in that role as head of marketing. And after I left, I was helping Soba, like very informally, Soba Beverages on the Gold Coast, which is an Indigenous-owned non-alcoholic beer company. I was consulting with a few other small businesses, and I was really inspired by what they were doing. I thought it was amazing, and I really wanted to work with them. Completely separately, it's sort of like a universe, you know, telling you, the universe pushing you in the right direction is sort of how I view it. But shortly shortly after sort of starting conversations with them, a friend of mine or an acquaintance, you know, that I'd met during my time at Young Henry's approached me and said, hey, we've actually been working on, we want to create our own non-alcoholic beer company. You know, they had a couple of ideas for names, and they said, we'd love to, you know, get you involved. Like, you know, do you want to work on this with us? This was Pete, who's now my co-founder, and he was running his own brand agency and didn't have beer experience, so he was really looking for someone to kind of come in and help to put some shape around this idea. And so, yeah, that sounded, you know, really exciting. I'd learned a little bit about the category from my conversations with Sober, and really kind of, for me, it was that meeting point of, you know, creating something physical, which is what I'd craved after so long in digital strategy. Mm-hmm. It was like pushing pixels around. I wanted a physical product, and I got that with my experience at Young Henry's. And I wanted something that was, you know, inherently creative. And so that was the sort of the starting my own business, and, you know, the ability to create something from scratch. And then a lot of the time on my previous ideas, it was that broader purpose. Like, I don't want to just put more stuff into the world. And that was the reason I killed a lot of my previous ideas of, you know, pajama labels and t-shirt companies and all this sort of stuff. You know, there was no reason for me to exist, or for that thing, that idea to exist in the world. Whereas, you know, Heaps Normal really jumped out to me as an opportunity to be part of a movement and a bigger purpose, as well as fulfilling all of those other personal, you know, things that I was looking for in my career. So yeah, Pete and I jumped on this idea together, and I gave Benny, by the point of the first things I did was give Benny a call. He was he's a really experienced head brewer who's worked with not only Young Henry's but Four Pines, Grifter, and yeah, a couple of others as well. And we sort of got to work. We created the brand first, and we went through reams and reams of names. A lot of them were terrible. We almost launched with a name that I'm really glad we didn't run with in the end.
Can you tell us the name?
Yeah, we thought we were really clever. We were going to call it Quiet Beer, and I think there was some merit in it. There was a reason and a rationale behind the name, but I shared it with a few friends, you know, the initial concepts with a few friends, and a couple of friends that I really respect just went, I think you can do better than that. You know, it's not exciting.
Be quiet.
It's not quiet. Fun. Yeah. And so I was a bit bruised, but went, okay, I trust these people. And I think that's again about kind of trusting the people who always build you up rather than, you know, the people who sort of don't believe in what you're doing. So these were people that I really trusted, and that, and so I listened to what they said, and we went back to the drawing board, and then, yeah, lightning struck, you know, and we came up with this name, and we all just immediately gravitated to it, and you know, felt like it was the one, and it gave us that sort of fun edge to playfulness, I think, that we all needed and saw as necessary in a beer brand.
And now's the fun part, right? You've got the name, you've got some co-founders. How do you bring this to life? And I know firsthand, having kind of taken a few brands off the ground in the FMCG world, it's hard work. It's not a software company where you can reiterate within an hour or get someone to code it differently. You need to find, like I said, a brewer. You need to find a manufacturer. You need to figure out where you want to launch, whether you go online, whether you go into retail. Tell me about the first 3 months, because I'm always fascinated, because I think that's really the hardest time, where you are figuring out the idea itself, you're learning as you're going, your confidence is probably not where it needs to be because you don't have this early traction. In reflection, what was those first 3 months like, and what were your kind of two or three focuses to get the ball running?
So I'll probably break it up into two first 3 months period.
Okay.
There was a period sort of around May when we were initially going to launch, and that was sort of very early days of, you know, discovering this thing called COVID and hearing about it in the news. And yeah, we thought, look, this is a terrible time to launch a business. You know, beer companies are struggling. You know, let's not run to market just yet. And so we hit pause and we thought, well, look, you know, this will all have blown over by summer. So we'll launch in October. Great time to launch, you know, and then, you know, be in market for that really peak period when everyone's outside enjoying beers. And so we hit the pause button, but we continued our R&D and work in the background. And then it got to, you know, got to June, I'd say, and we thought, look, this is, you know, retail is still going really strong. You know, the on-premise side of the business is still struggling, but, you know, this sector of non-alc is, you know, I guess we noticed that the time is now, like we have to go now. And so we thought, we just went as hard as we could to get it out as soon as we could. And it was really scary because we still weren't really sure, you know, what the impact of the pandemic was going to be. And, on top of all the usual fears of like, are people going to, you know, resonate with this brand that we've created? Are people going to want this product? And so we went so hard. We hustled more than I think we ever have collectively. And we sold 80% of our first batch before we'd even brewed it.
Wow.
And so that was sort of that couple of months leading up to the brew being packaged and landing in market.
And was that just reaching out to people in your network, and or was it cold calling retailers and customers?
Both. We initially, we packaged our very first trial batch. We put it just in blank cans, and when we, like, Pete had his whole family on a production line putting like little heaps on blank cans, and we sent them out to friends and family and a few of our contacts in the brewing industry, and just said, hey, what do you think about this? You know, do you like it? You know, how much alcohol do you think's in there? And so many people came back and just said, like, I love it. You know, is that a mid-strength beer, or, you know, maybe 3 or 4%? And these were people who were professional brewers and sommeliers as well in amongst this group. And so that was the most exciting moment for us, where we thought, okay, we're onto something here. This is, you know, something that other people are going to like as well, not just us. We cold called. I think the beer industry is one of those industries where it's traditionally very face-to-face, but we, again, it's another example of a very non-traditional pathway that we've had for a beer company. In hindsight, it was a silver lining to be able to be stuck at home, and for it to be okay for us to be emailing and talking about and having sales conversations with venues on all corners of the country, without necessarily having to turn up at their doorstep with a cold can of beer for them to sample.
That's really the hardest part, right? I remember that, taking the samples and trying to find an Esky, and it sounds very trivial, but it's so logistically heavy to do that. I'm sure it was easier. And I remember last year, I mean, even early this year, like if I'd go on Twitter, if I'd look at any VC angel founder in Australia, Heaps Normal would always appear in my newsfeed. Tell me about that. Was that a conscious sort of decision to reach out to that kind of segment of the population and then send them samples or get them interested in your brand?
It was. I wouldn't say necessarily VCs in the beginning, but we, Nick, one of your earlier guests and who's a very dear friend of mine, Nick Crocker, he was one of the first people that I contacted when we put this idea together, and I said, you know, what do you think about this? Is this something that Blackbird, you know, might be interested in? Like, have we got the right idea? And I realized at that point that he was a very big fan of the category personally, and he'd been sort of going down to his Black Hearts and local Black Hearts and Sparrows and asking them, you know, what new non-alc beers have you got? Like, you know, for about 6 months prior to us kind of getting to market. And so he was our first, I think, foot into the startup landscape. And a couple of other friends, brought Gary Williams, brought my attention to Startmate. And I reached out to Nick and said, oh, look, do you think this is something that we should apply for? And he said, absolutely, 1,000% you should apply for Startmate. He said, you won't get in. And I was like, oh okay. but it'll be a great experience. Just the process of going through that selection process and talking about your business will be really beneficial. You should do it. So we did, and we kept, you know, there's several rounds of interviews and applications and written stuff for Startmate, and we kept getting through to the next round and thought, oh, you know, that's fine, like, great, we got through the next round, but we'll see how that goes, and we'll just use that as a chance to refine our pitch. And then, yeah, we got all the way through and we got accepted into Startmate. And so that was just a real kind of pinch yourself moment. You know, it came with a little bit of funding, and for us at the time that was game changing in itself. But the real game changer for us came off, you know, in the actual accelerator and participating in the network that we were exposed to. But I think, again, even more beyond the network that we're exposed to, just how Startmate gave us, you know, stretched our ambitions on, you know, what we saw as possible for ourselves and for our business in a short period of time was, you know, pushed, you know, further than we could have imagined. Lost my train of thought, but the ambition that Startmate gave us was something that I think put us in the right frame of mind, you know, for the traction that we received afterwards.
How good a story is that? And I'm sure Nick has more respect for you because you proved him wrong. So that kind of, in a funny way, is probably giving you more credibility, right? That he was 1,000% clear that you went on and got accepted. I actually asked him for a couple of questions that he would like to ask you. And one of the questions he sent me was kind of relative to what you hoped Heaps Normal would be. Have you met, or would you say you've exceeded the expectations from when you launched at a personal level?
Compared to what we thought Heaps Normal could or would be at this point, when we launched, it has far exceeded anything that we thought was possible. But I credit that to Startmate and other parts of the startup ecosystem, like the Canberra Innovation Network, our mentors that we've had, you know, and our investment group, the investors that have believed in Heaps Normal from very early on, the difference, I think, between us being a modestly successful micro brewer and, you know, being, I think, probably not too boastful to say, I think that, you know, Heaps Normal is one of the category leaders in the non-alc beer space in Australia now. And I think just the backing, the support, and the right amount of engagement from a group who are leaders in their field across, you know, music, startups, consumer brands, the most of the people backing Heaps Normal have been there and done it all before, and let a category change to category. And yeah, they're so experienced, skilled, but also so generous with their time that that's, I think, made the difference for us.
And I think the part that I'm really excited about is you're giving a beacon of hope to other businesses like who want to do something like yourself and build a physical product and launch it into a retail channel or an online channel and sort of broaden the minds of some of the investors and some of the traditional tech software companies. And I think you've seen that with yourselves. You've seen that with a number of other companies like Fable and Buddy and a few others that have kind of come through the ranks. So now time for the final sprint, Andy, because I'm sure you've got things to get to and I'm conscious of time. So just some rapid fire questions. And if you can give me 60 second answers, is there one investment in your life that you consider the best? And it doesn't have to be financial.
Look, I think I don't want to sound like a cliche, but the investment in my kids, I think for me is something that's so rewarding because you know it's bigger than yourself, but it's also, you know, it's this opportunity to find a way to pass on everything that you've learned and all of your failures and successes, you know, in what feels like a very short period of time, short life, onto somebody else, and you know, see how they make use of it.
Mm. And in the spirit of time, I'll keep it to one last question. Is there one thing you want to learn in the next 6 months?
There are so many things that I need and want to learn in the next 6 months. I think, I'm just learning how to be a great CEO. For me, that's a new thing. I am grateful to have people around me that have done it to a really high standard and who are great mentors to me. I think Jadon Comerford from Unified Music Group is somebody that I have a huge amount of respect for and take a lot from. How to be an effective leader of and how to use that to take Heaps Normal to the next phase of its life cycle. That's what I would like to learn.
Mm, exciting. Well, that's the finish line, Andy. Thank you so much for sharing your journey and bringing this product into the world. And again, if listeners you haven't tried the product, please do. And I'm sure Heaps Normal will be available around the world in the next couple of months, if not years. So if any listeners outside of Australia, I'm sure they can get their hands on it very soon. But thank you again. Wish you all the best and keep in touch.
Thanks, Fidit. Really appreciate the chat.
I hope you took away some actionable insights and learnings from this conversation to apply to your lives and be 1% better every day. And I look forward to sharing the next episode with you next Tuesday. Stay tuned.